that we think are a good sampling of the breadth and the quality of research being done, enabled through SharkNet. So the first speaker, Ilias Kotsirias, he's from Wilfrid Laurier University. He's a professor in the Department of Physics and Computer Science. And he's also the chair of the ACM, or Association for Computing Machinery, special interest group on symbolic and algebraic manipulation. So, Ilias, if you can come on up. Actually, I think we have your presentation here. Perfect. Okay.
Okay. First of all, thanks to the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. What I wanted to do today is to discuss some recent advances in the theory and search for complementary sequences. So I will tell you what these are and discuss these recent advances that we were able to obtain. But first, I want to also introduce my collaborators. First, Professor Dragomir Djokovic from the University of Waterloo, Dr. Oleg Golubitsky from Google Inc. Here in town, Daniel Rekoski, a student at the University of Guelph and subsequently at the University of Waterloo, and Joe Savada, professor at the University of Guelph. So here's the outline of the talk. First, I'm going to introduce periodic and aperiodic autocorrelation of a finite sequence. Then I will discuss what complementary sequences are. Then discuss the main contribution of this work, which is a concept of compression of complementary sequences. Then I will also try to explain why complementary sequences are important, because they help us to put together a unified description of combinatorial objects. Then I will discuss alternative formulations of problems that have to do with complementary sequences. And finally, mention some of the new results that we were able to obtain in the past couple of years. So let me start with the definition of periodic and aperiodic autocorrelation. Basically, you start with a finite sequence of length n, and you shift the sequence by 1 or by 2 or by s in general, and this is a cyclic shift, and then you take the inner product of the original sequence and the shifted sequence. And this is the definition of periodic autocorrelation up here. As a technicality, I'm just going to mention that this index k plus s, of course, is taken modulo n, so that you stay inside the indices of the sequence from 0 to n minus 1. The aperiodic autocorrelation is similar, only now you have less terms. So basically, whatever is left over terms after you do the shift by s, you discard them. You don't consider them in the inner product. So this is the definition of aperiodic autocorrelation. And you can also, in this work, we are mostly concerned with sequences that are binary. And by binary, we mean having terms plus and minus 1, or ternary sequences where we allow a 0. You can also have complex number elements in those sequences. But in that case, you have to replace this term here by the complex conjugate, so that you have a consistent and correct definition of autocorrelation. So here's an example, just to make things a little bit more concrete for you. Here is a sequence of length 7, and these are the periodic autocorrelation terms, and these are the aperiodic autocorrelation terms. And you can see that you can, if you put together NA6 and NA1, then you make up PA1. So you have this kind of property in general, which is useful later on. Circulant matrices is another ingredient in this research, a very important ingredient. A circulant matrix is basically a matrix which is defined by its first row, because every other row is a cyclic shift of the first row. So you end up with a constant along the main diagonal. Basically, this is a kind of a toplids, a special kind of a toplids matrix that everybody is familiar with. There are a lot of properties between periodic and aperiodic autocorrelation, and also things, concepts that are very well studied in combinatorics, like this one, E2, the second elementary symmetric function in n variables. If you add all of the periodic autocorrelation terms together, then you end up with twice the second elementary symmetric function in n variables. And this is an object that is very well studied in combinatorics. Unified description of combinatorial objects. One of the reasons that periodic and aperiodic autocorrelation are important functions to study are because they can be used to give a unified description for very many combinatorial objects. And this is just a small sample of those objects. So if you have one sequence, ternary sequence, so with plus minus ones and zero, so that all of the aperiodic autocorrelation terms are equal to zero, then this is called a Barker sequence. And these are very well studied in combinatorics. Next case, if you have a ternary sequence with periodic autocorrelation terms summing to zero, all of them, then these are called circulant weighing matrices, another object which is very well studied in combinatorics and has connections with various areas that I will mention in a minute, and so on and so forth. You can also have two sequences or more, four or more, with properties that are described via periodic and aperiodic autocorrelation, and you are able to construct combinatorial objects here in the third column, such as the optimal matrices, Hadamard matrices, which are used widely in optics, quantum computing, and so on. So this is part of the reason why those sequences are important, because they allow us to give this unified description of several different combinatorial objects. So here is a toy example that I want to use to illustrate what we're trying to do with those sequences. My toy example has 100 binary variables, so this is already a quite difficult and challenging example to work out. So this is my definition of the periodic autocorrelation function in MAPLE. Being in Waterloo and from Waterloo, you kind of implicitly you have to use MAPLE in your computations, of course. What else? This is just a joke. Don't take it seriously. So then you compute all of the periodic autocorrelation function terms of the first sequence and then of the second sequence, and then you remark something, some phenomenon that is happening. If you add those two terms corresponding to those two sequences, element-wise, you always get a zero. So 2 minus 2, 2 minus 2, and so on, 6 minus 6, and so on. So you end up with 25 zeros. This is not accidental, obviously. This is an occurrence of a very rare phenomenon. These are two sequences that are very hard to find, and in fact, nobody knew how to find them until 2007, when they were discovered by us and by another group independently. And this is what we call complementary sequences. So the general definition of complementary sequence is the following. Suppose that you have T sequences of the same length, then if you compute the periodic autocorrelation terms of all of them and you sum them together and you get a constant alpha, then these are called complementary sequences. So in the previous example, we had two sequences and the periodic autocorrelation constant alpha was zero. You notice that there is a term here, a alpha zero, which corresponds to the periodic autocorrelation function at shift 0, which is simply the sum of the squares of the elements of the sequence, and that is trivial to compute, of course, when you know that your sequence has elements plus and minus 1. Applications of autocorrelation sequences, I will just mention briefly some of them. By the way, another term for those sequences is low off-peak autocorrelation sequences. And I will start with communication engineering problems. There is a very nice book by Manfred Schroeder in 84 that explains those applications. Wireless telecommunication protocols, CDMA, and things like that. Again, there is a very nice book by Golomb and Gong in 2005, where they explain applications in cryptography and radar applications. And finally, here's an application which is more interesting to physicists, and this is a physics institute. There are many physicists here. So sequences with low off-peak autocorrelation have been used in this paper and other similar papers by the same team of authors in high-precision interplanetary measurements to check out space-time curvature, and this has to do with this the famous fourth test of general relativity. I don't know a lot more about this application, but if people are interested, you can refer to these papers. Unfortunately, searching for complementary sequences is hard. And one way to explain how hard it is to employ these metaphors from art and from evolutionary biology. This is a haystack, as painted by the famous French painter Claude Monet. And what we're doing is that we're looking for a needle in the haystack. And often enough, we're lucky that we can find it. The other metaphor that I wanted to mention is the junkyard tornado metaphor from evolutionary biology that basically it has to do with the idea that what if a tornado went through a junkyard and made a 747? What's the probability of that happening? And that probability is very, very small. It's about 1 over 10 to the 40,000 or something like that. So this is the kind of numbers, the kind of probabilities that we're up against in this research. So let me keep going with mentioning another invariant, which is important in this research. So the first invariant was the PAF, the periodic autocorrelation function. It turns out there is a second invariant of a different nature, even though it looks the same. And that second invariant is the power spectral density, this PSD invariant. And it turns out that if you sum the PSD terms associated to complementary sequences, you still get a constant in the same way that you got a constant up here. So the complementary sequences are characterized by two sets of constants, periodic autocorrelation constants and PSD constants, so alpha and beta, and these are the relationships between the two. Let me say a little bit more about what exactly is power spectral density. Well, it was introduced by Jennifer Siberry from Australia some time ago, maybe 20 years ago. It was introduced in the search for complementary sequences. I know that there are similar things in harmonic analysis that have different names like Rudin-Shapiro polynomials and things like that. So basically what you do is that you take the discrete Fourier transform of your sequence and then you take the square magnitudes of those elements of the discrete Fourier transform, and this is your power spectral density terms. There is an important relationship between PAF and PSD invariants, which is described here by the Wiener Kinzin theorem. And also you can think of the Parseval theorem from Fourier analysis. The Parseval theorem is kind of a horizontal relationship between the elements of a sequence and its discrete Fourier transform. And the PSD theorem or criterion is sort of a vertical relationship between the elements of those two sequences. So here is the PSD criterion, and I want to illustrate it with a particular case study. This case study is the case of the optimal matrices, where you have two sequences with plus and minus one elements, so that the PAF constants sum to zero, so alpha is zero, and the PSD constants sum to 2n, so beta is equal to 2n, where n is the length of the sequence. And this is for every possible n. Then the PSD criterion is the very simple observation that if for a certain sequence there exists an index I so that the value of the PSD invariant is bigger than this constant beta, then this sequence cannot be used to find the solution in the optimal problem. So the PSD criterion allows you to discard very many sequences, and in fact, in most cases, it allows you to discard anywhere between 90 and 99.9% of the entire space. Of course, 99.9% of an exponential space is still a very large space. But anyway, we're not doing brute force. That's for sure. We're not doing brute force algorithms. The important consequence of this PSD criterion is that you can decouple the PAF equations, those two here. And so you cut down the complexity in half already. And then on top of that, you apply another 90 or 95% reduction. I think I'm running out of time slowly, and thanks, Nasser. So this is an illustration of, so I illustrated to you in Maple previously the PAF invariant. This is an illustration of the PSD invariant. You see that for those two sequences that we had, the PSD constant turns out to be equal to 100. And how is this materialized? Well, you compute the PSD values for your first sequence, and then the PSD values for the second sequence, and they all sum respectively, correspondingly to 100 for all possible shifts. And again, this is a very rare phenomenon. This is an occurrence of the complementary sequences phenomenon. So compression, our contribution, so it turns out that surprisingly, complementary sequences have been studied for a very long time, but it turns out that surprisingly, there are still some theoretical progress that can be done that also has important algorithmic consequences. And this is the concept of compression. So basically, what we do is that we take our sequence, we consider sums of d elements, where d is a divisor of the order of the sequence, and we put them together in a new sequence of length d, and we study the properties of this new sequence. As an example, here is a combinatorial object called CW249, so 24 elements plus minus ones and zeros, 9 non-zero elements, and the remaining are zeros. So if you compress this sequence by 2, then you get this degree 12, or order 12 sequence. If you compress it by 3, you get this length 8 sequence. And the surprising part is that these compressed sequences have a lot of the same properties from the original complementary sequences. So to make this more precise, what we proved in 2012 is that if you have a set of complementary sequences and if you compress them by a certain factor, all of them, then you end up with a set of compressed sequences which are again complementary. And you can find the PAF constants of the compressed sequences. Here they are. You just multiply your original PAF constant by m, where m is the compression factor. And surprisingly, the PSD constants are the same. So the PSD constants of the original complementary sequences and the compressed complementary sequences are the same. And this is very important in terms of computational consequences, algorithms, and so on. I'm going to skip a few things in the interest of time and mention that another important ingredient in this research is that Sometimes there are explicit formulas for the discrete Fourier transform and the power spectral density invariant for those sequences that we're interested in. And this is one case here that I want to talk about. So if the length of the sequence is a multiple of 3, then it turns out that the PSD value at n over 3, this is m, is given by this explicit formula where these are sums of the terms modulo 1, modulo 2, and modulo 3, respectively. So this is, again, very useful in terms of computation. You don't have to compute DFTs, which are expensive and so on, and roots of unity. You can use this simple formula to compute your PSD value. There is a whole bunch of algorithms that I unfortunately won't have time to go into that we use in this research, and I use them myself in the past 11 or 12 years or so. First of all, there is the union of orbits approach, string sorting, which is a theoretical computer science-based method, randomized string sorting, and of course, metaheuristic algorithms like all of these here that many of you know and use, genetic algorithms, ant colony optimization, annealing, taboo search, and anything else that you can think of. The main idea in these algorithms is that you try to use all of your theoretical results and practical optimizations to prune the search space, which is, of course, exponentially large. So let me skip here and show one of the results that we had. We constructed a new deoptimal matrix of order 482, which comes from two sequences that have PAF plus 2 and length 241 each. So this is a problem with about 480, close to 500 binary variables. And the way that we did it is that, of course, we used all of our algorithms and also a lot of CPU time. And this reminds me of SarkNet's motto, computing tomorrow's solutions. So actually, we are computing tomorrow's solutions today. In terms of objective functions, when you use genetic algorithms and so on, the problem with all of these metaheuristic algorithms is that they get stuck when it comes to local minima of your objective function. And unfortunately, the functions that we're working with have several trillions of local minima. So any metaheuristic algorithm that we have tried, not only ourselves, but also we've worked with other experts in various metaheuristic techniques, they all suffer from the same problem. And the problem is here. These are the local minima up here, and these are the zeros down here. So you see that of the objective function. So you see that the local minima up here create this sort of impenetrable wall that causes algorithms, metaheuristic algorithms, to fail. So every so often, we have some successes with metaheuristic algorithms, but this is where the main problem lies. So if you know how to treat local minima, please come and talk to me. I would be very happy to find out. So just to finish, I want to discuss interactions with coding theory. And these are best described by a movie.
I don't know.
Sorry about that. I'll try to find the clip that I'm interested in. So this is some sort of Hollywood rendition.
Hey, don't flatter yourself.
Of coding theory.
Pick me up at 3.
Yes.
That's not
While
the part.
The number field sieve is the best method currently known, there exists an intriguing possibility for a far more elegant approach. Here we would find a
combination
of extensions, each abelian over the rationals, and hence contained in a single cyclotomic field. Using the Artin map, we might induce homomorphisms from the principal orders in each of these fields that you said.
You seen anybody?
Yeah. These maps could then be used to combine splitting information from all the
This isn't just about
codes, large number theory, and other terms. That's how Hollywood sees mathematicians and physicists and what they do. But in real life, the interactions of this work with coding theory are best explained in this recent book, Grobner Basis, Coding and Cryptography, where the authors describe an open problem in coding theory, and actually the solution to this open problem goes through someone being able to construct as many skew-Hadamard matrices of order 32 as possible. So this is one of the interactions with coding theory. There are several other interactions with coding theory that I won't have time to go into. I just want to finish. I don't know how am I doing on time. Maybe I'm out of time. I will just mention some interactions with quantum computing, which are particularly important for this audience. There are those two papers by Flamia Severini and Wim van Dam that describe how weighing matrices, which are some sort of combinatorial objects that I told you about, how they're used in quantum computing. So let me come to my last slide, which is future work. What we want to do is that we want to, first of all, exploit the symmetries of this problem, and this is a very non-trivial endeavor. Then we want to explore the applicability of emerging high-performance computing paradigms like FPGA, GPU, and what comes next. Improve and further optimize our algorithms, which we do all the time. Intensify our study with coding theory and interactions with coding theory and quantum computing. Deepen our understanding of metaheuristic methods, and especially using landscape theory. And also systematize how we use compression, both at the theoretical and practical levels. And finally, I want to mention this quote by a famous number theorist, Karl Pomerans. What he wrote a couple of decades ago is this now the limit of what we can do? It may very well be, but we certainly advances will not be made by people who think they cannot succeed. So we belong to the category of people who believe that we can succeed and we will succeed. Thank you. Thank you.